Hello, hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friends Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, and today I'm joined by Mr. Chris Hutton. Chris, we've missed you for a while, but welcome back. How are you doing?
Hi, Nick. Yeah, thanks very much. Good to be back. I've missed you very much as well. That's why we've spent quite a few hours together today. So I think we're reaching our quota maybe for the week. I'll have to take another month leave from your aura, I think.
I know. It's awfully intimidating. And we also have Mr. Herman Pretorius. Herman, how are you doing?
That was the best I could do.
As the kids say, I feel your vibe, man. All right. First, a note before we get started. The IRA is coming to KZN next week, and we're very interested in meeting friends of the show, friends of the Institute of Race Relations, friends of the Daily Friend. So if you are interested in meeting up with our CEO, John Endres, and Gabriel Krauser, one of our regular contributors, we will be near Howick on the 16th of November at 6 o'clock in the tap room at the Midlands Fable on 85 Curry's Post Road. And on the 17th of November, we're going to be at Garden Court in Mhlanga at 6 o'clock as well, at the, which is on the corner of Aurora and Centenary Boulevard, in meeting room Mfolozi 1 and 2. So I'll put those details again in the comments section of the YouTube video. But if you want to meet us in person and hear a little bit about what we think about the country and just have a chat, you can check us out there. All right. So first news of today. We're going to finish with some foreign news, but let's see what's potting in South Africa. Oh, look, it's another bad idea. there was an article that Chris sent me titled, "It's Time to Get Serious About SAA for the Sea." And that government has begun dusting off what has been described as a radical shipping plan. So the theory here goes that the time has now come to create what would essentially be a South African Airways for the Sea, to free South Africa from total reliance on foreign shipping companies. The Department of Transport announced a series of public consultation workshops due to be held at the end of this month on a draft of the South African Shipping Company Bill, which it described as an initiative inspired by the Comprehensive Maritime Transport Policy. The document originally dates back to 2017, but there's now a belief that changes in the global economy call for the establishment of a shipping line that, if not owned by the state, then is at least under South African control. The department said, "The shipping of our essential imports and exports is mostly reliant on foreign governments and companies, and this might not be able to shield South Africa from supply chain disruptions, especially during times of natural disaster or international conflict. The idea here is to create a shipping company which would have priority in South Africa's ports, which is a pretty big deal because South Africa's ports are pretty congested and slow. So if you have priority, then that would set back other shipping companies even further. And really push you, give you a huge advantage over them, as well as a number of other subsidies and benefits." Chris, you're very into logistics. You're very into looking at supply chains. Can you explain what's wrong with this idea? Why shouldn't South Africa be having its own logistical company that's not, you know, I don't know, going to be cut off because China decides this or because America decides this? Why shouldn't we be dependent on foreign shipping companies? Why should we?
What a time to be alive, especially when you're interested in trade and logistics policy, when many countries are throwing up protectionist barriers, increasing costs, adding to inflation. Why shouldn't South Africa go down the same route? I guess if other countries are going to have high inflation, why shouldn't we as well? Maybe that's how we can balance it out in a way. With our currency devaluing, with our own manufacturing capacity going down as a result of the government's own ideological and policy choices, why not undermine that even further? So I think, so there's the principle argument and the pragmatic argument. The pragmatic argument, and I apologize to my colleague Martin Mastarden for using that word. I'm sure somewhere he's very upset that I use that. But pragmatically and practically, if you centralize anything in the hands of a bureaucratic few, a board, for example, appointed by the Minister of Transport or the Minister of Infrastructure in this case, or the Minister of Ships, the Minister of the Mast, whatever you want to call it, you're going to increase the chance that perverse incentives happen, that only certain individuals are favored, only certain networks, only certain businesses who are in the room with that board, for example, can decide who gets what. We see it now with the localization master plans. The minutes of those meetings haven't been necessarily released in all cases. We don't know who gets to decide higher tariffs, who doesn't. So in this case of a shipping company, who gets to decide who gets preference? Who gets to decide what goods or services, components, materials get put on which ships, and that they then get preference at the country's harbors? Another practical point, if you look at how South Africa's ports and rail have been going ever downward in terms of performance, the ports always ranked at the bottom of the global port performance index. I don't see how adding more layers of bureaucracy and control in this way is going to solve those basic trade infrastructure issues. So making sure that digitization happens better at Durban and Cape Town, making sure that there are more brackets for trucks to load containers onto, making sure that you can track as an importer or exporter your good into the harbor, through it and onto a truck and into the rest of the country. How does this solve any of those particular low-hanging fruit problems? So I think it's very much this grandiose big government developmental state point of view, wanting to get growth going, activity, that sort of thing, but it's going to impose a lot of intermediaries, non-value adding intermediaries especially, and it's going to increase costs across the board. I can see, if I really want to play devil's advocate, I can see the concern around imported inflation, and when you've got supply chain disruptions around the world, yes, you're more exposed to that kind of thing. But you don't solve that by adding more burdens and costs and bureaucratic layers onto importers and exporters in the form of a state-owned shipping company. You do that, for example, by unlocking competition in electricity, so you up your own manufacturing base. So companies here can manufacture the goods instead of importing them. So that you are then less reliant on imported inflation, for example. So you get those other basics right, and then you won't be so exposed to imported inflation and concerns around global supply chain issues. I think this is very much going to add just more wastage, more inefficiency, and more burdens on the South African economy as a whole, because the only way that you're going to get your stuff out or into the country is if you've got the necessary political influence, if you've got enough money to throw around under the table, as it were, that sort of thing. So very much going in the wrong direction, but as we do with most of our policy proposals at this point.
So, Chris, just before I go to you, Herman, this also reminds me of a particular foreign piece of legislation in the US that's received a little bit of pushback recently, especially in kind of free market circles. And this is a thing called the Jones Act. Do you just maybe want to talk about, like, what the effect of that has been? It's not quite the same as what the government here is proposing, but there are a lot of overlaps.
Yeah, just one example of the pernicious effects of the Jones Act when a place like Puerto Rico suffers from a natural disaster and needs aid. Ships that want to take aid from the U.S. are not allowed to dock there if they weren't built in the U.S. in the first place. So it's got this designation idea around where a ship has to be built and where the goods it is transporting are from, or where they were initially manufactured, where they were warehoused. So adding a lot of additional bureaucracy and layers such as that, and again, delays. We saw this a few months ago with the baby formula shortages in the U.S., where they could have been imported, the stocks could have been imported much faster, much cheaper, but they simply couldn't be because of the Jones Act provision. So this idea of shipping maybe being in the quote-unquote in the national interest, and the way for the government to protect that is by making sure that you simply don't have a choice in terms of what you use. And again, the perverse incentives idea. So here, the idea is to maybe protect you from global supply chain disruptions, make sure that the country isn't exposed to when that happens. But the effect is that you disincentivize the building of ships as they would have been before, because the only way that you can get your ship built is if you get bureaucratic approval, that sort of thing. Then you lessen the chance that people are going to invest that sort of capital, that innovation. And then in the end, you lead to a shortage of shipping and containers over the long run, which is what you didn't want in the first place, but which affects everyone in your country over the long run. And again, which is exacerbating something like the high inflation that we're seeing at the moment.
Right. So, you know, if a country with the world's largest economy and largest in tonnage military fleet can't get shipping right because of protectionist laws, I shudder to think what a South African state-owned shipping company would do. Herman, one of the reasons that has been put forward in suggesting why we do need an SAA of the sea is that apparently the military and navy are concerned that in the event of some kind of overseas deployment, they will not be able to properly ship enough weapons and supplies to South African troops posted overseas. Your thoughts? Could you expand on that?
No. Yes, well, okay, let me try. Chris speaks about the fact that this is sort of part of the developmental state idea. The problem is we don't really have developed South Africa. We just have mental state in the sense that what is the question to which a state-run shipping entity is the answer? I mean, let's perhaps look at the wonderful successes of SOEs in South Africa. Eskom, Telk. It just becomes, it's beyond ridiculous to at this point even think beyond the theoretical chambers of, you know, some obscure Afro-socialist Fabian society, drinking game, that this is a solution to any of the problems we face. And to add to that the component of, oh, if there's a war, we might not be able to ship weapons to our armed forces. I mean, it's quite possible that our armed forces are more lethal without those weapons. I mean, have you seen the videos?
Our pilots get barely any flying time as it is because there's no fuel for them.
No, but don't say that.
They don't have supplies to ship.
So that's part of the problem. But the low-hanging fruits point that Chris makes is, and I'm nowhere near an expert on trade and supply chains as he is, but it just strikes me as blatant where if we have a cost of living crisis, where can we actually improve costs and manufacturing? And these are, how about we have a reliable power supply or an energy market that could at least sustain productivity in locally? How about we ensure that road infrastructure and rail infrastructure are reliable internally, just moving labor and goods around within the country? If you look at the state of the world and you think that a state-owned shipping company in South Africa is the answer to something, it really is as if you have no connection to reality. The problem in the South African ports aren't priority docking or priority treatment in any of the ports. It's the fact that the ports themselves are collapsing. There are two reasons to support this policy if you're in the ANC. And it goes to the fact that the ANC has two factions, people who want to take your money and people who want to steal your money. The ideological reason is that some moron like Abraham Patel might actually believe this is a sound idea, that this is genuinely socialist utopia in becoming. And the other more cynical and to my mind more probable explanation is this is another opportunity, another excuse for some rent seeking. This is another excuse to either get some money from the private sector for preferential treatment, or just to create some more jobs for more cadres, for more patronage.
You can see a middleman who buys a ship from South Korea, hikes the price up by 20%, and then sells it back to the South African shipping company.
Exactly. And already, if we're going to be immensely kind, COVID, the last 2 years have really forced people to reconsider global supply chains. That's undeniable. But the question surely must then be asked, right, if we have to stabilize supply chains, what is a responsible way to do it? Is it to try the SAA, Eskom, Denel route, or is it possibly to just incentivize companies to establish a presence in South Africa? and then arrange tax, financial, regulatory incentives for companies to come here and not add a burden to the taxpayer, but actually allow for a service to be delivered on favorable terms to the government. It's just insane. It is genuinely insane that with the size of the national debt, with a shrinking tax base, with a shrinking economy in terms of per capita in real terms, with the track record of SOEs in this country, we have a possible consideration of doing something like this again. And one of our other stories we might look at might actually give some balance to this. This is also the party that looked at the health situation in South Africa and said, you know what the solution to that might be? Beasts of burden.
Yeah, so on that point, on that brilliant segue, the DA and Action SA have attacked a tender put out by the Northwest Department of Community Safety and Road Management because it plans to spend 780,000 Rand on, no, not ambulances, not infrastructure upgrades, not hospitals, but donkey carts. This is a plan to spend 780,000 Rand to acquire 20 donkey carts, which will be given to some villages in very, very rural areas of Northwest. Apparently, the cost doesn't just include the donkey carts themselves, but also a three-year service plan to ensure that they can continue to work. According to the Community Safety MEC, this office, the project seeks to alleviate challenges faced by rural communities. The carts are reportedly used to ferry sick people to clinics, pupils to schools, people needing assistance to and from the shops, and elderly people to pension pay points. So there get to be some two-seaters, which cost 32,000 Rand each, and some four-seaters, which cost 45,000 Rand each. Both the DA and Action SA said that the DA saying, quote, not only does this donation smack of brazen corruption, it's also a clear indication of the ANC's disregard for the needs and dignity of residents. The ANC has failed to invest in ambulances and proper transport infrastructure for this province over the years, and patients are being told to use donkey carts as a means of transport. This is why cabinet ministers drive around in luxury cars. And Action SA said, after 28 years of ANC rule in Northwest, one would expect they know how people's needs and will implement programs that will take them out of poverty, but they keep failing. The donation of these carts is another clear example. The ANC government has no plan nor will to change people's lives.
Can I be very, very quick on this, and then I'll chuck it over to Chris for his in-depth analysis. It is astounding what an admission of failure this is. Donkey carts, in a very, very bizarre way, make sense if you have no roads, no rail, and no air transport facilities. Then it sort of makes sense to, you know, rough it out pioneer style, because essentially you're taking the country back to the early 1800s. The speed at which it is possible to deindustrialize and de-develop this country is something quite astounding. It is something quite astounding. And that there were ANC politicians who didn't kill this idea when it first, you know, came about on probably some sticky note or a chappy wrapper is sort of a testament to the fact that this party hasn't only run out of ideas, it has run out of the century in terms of thinking that this might be a solution. And if we can be as charitable as possible and say that, you know, fuel costs are high and sort of donkeys might be a more effective way of doing this, it just boggles the mind as to how they think these beasts of burden will be looked after. I mean, will the Speaker of Parliament make some place on her farm where that some of the donkeys can go live there before they, you know, inevitably eat each other from hunger and desperation? It is beyond parody. I, for the whole discussion before the show here, I was sort of thinking, you know, Herman, are you going through the checklist in your mind for making sure you didn't have a stroke or something? Because this is, it is beyond ridiculous. And that's not even getting to the point of saying to a desperately ill, socioeconomically deprived South African in a vulnerable area, oh, you need medical treatment. How about you wait a couple of hours for a donkey to pitch up? I mean, why didn't they just go for, what's a kreva in English? Wheelbarrows. Why didn't they just go for wheelbarrows? I mean, at least with a wheelbarrow, you can give more of them out and you don't have to wait for the donkey to pitch. It just, once you arrive at this level of uselessness, and voters don't kick you out, then there's a question about what the hell are your opposition parties doing?
I see in the comments that Sam says that he reckons that donkey cart normally go for 10,000 to 12,000 rand. So there's a lot of expenses being put into that maintenance plan. But what really strikes me about this is just the lack of ambition. I actually, maybe this is the most practical way for some of these communities to be connected to the health system and to get transport, you know, in short term to them. But doesn't that say something about how this is just a failure? This should not be the case. And it's sort of almost an admission of defeat of, well, I guess we'll do something. And maybe this is the first thing that some of these people in these rural villages will have gotten from government in a very long time. Chris, your thoughts?
I'd need to add that I don't think we should, at this point, we can't say anymore that the National Democratic Revolution has failed. It has very much succeeded at bringing South Africans to a very low level in terms of them not having access to basic services, not having access to responsible government, that their tax money isn't used for what it should be used for. So don't talk about it as a failure anymore. It's a resounding success for those with the necessary political connections. And yeah, just a final point. We often express frustration or surprise at these sorts of proposals and these plans. If the NHI is implemented, this sort of thing will proliferate around the country. Don't be surprised, because you're definitely going to see a squandering of resources on a scale we haven't seen before. And you'll see tenders and plans such as these going to those who have the connections on the NHI fund board, for example, who know that they can get something out of this. And it doesn't really matter what service is delivered to the poor indigent citizens on the ground.
And Nick, just the last thing to really show how bizarre this is. 2 years ago, Ramaphosa was in Parliament speaking about smart cities and, you know, bullet trains. Boy, did that, I mean, we skipped a couple of steps there. We've gone straight past, you know, nuclear fallout, and we're back to rebuilding society. With the wheel being a recent contribution to our socioeconomic circumstances. It is pathetic. It is genuinely pathetic, and it reminds of Ramaphosa staring in wonder at a pothole being fixed. If there's anyone out there with some notion that perhaps it's the Economist who endorsed the man, with some notion that Ramaphosa can restore some form of dignity to his party and to national government, it is you know, time to develop a drinking problem.
Indeed. I've just had a look on Google Maps at where these villages are. Can't quite find them exactly, but they're having a look around the town they're at. And you'd be mistaken for thinking this was the 1800s, some of these places. It's just ancient roads that aren't unpaved and dry, desolate landscapes with very little on them. And that's unfortunately the tale of so much of Northwest. But anyway, let's move on to our last topic for today. And we're going to move overseas to talk about something less sort of depressing, which is the rather surprising results of the U.S. midterms. So midterms are when one-third of the Senate and the entirety of the House of Representatives, which are the two chambers of the U.S. legislature, go up for re-election. And they're called midterms because they're in the middle of a president's term. They're usually considered to be quite important for setting the stage for the next presidential election and also on the legislative agenda in the second half of a president's term. So generally speaking, presidents, for at least the past couple of decades, have done pretty badly in their midterms. George W. Bush's second midterm went pretty badly. Barack Obama had two bad midterms, 2014 and 2010. Donald Trump had a bad one as well in 2018. Joe Biden has not had a great one. His party looks like it's probably going to lose the House of Representatives to the Republicans. It's still too close to call, which, considering the economic problems that the U.S. is going through right now, the very high levels of inflation and economic uncertainty and the unpopularity of Joe Biden, his party has done surprisingly well in these midterms, much better than expectations that they were going to be crushed, or as people refer to it, there would be a red wave where the Republican Party would sweep over the country and win many House seats. So I think, you know what, we're still waiting for results, so the picture may change a little bit here or there, but I think the bottom line, the thing that's not going to change, is that the Republicans didn't do as well as they thought they would. So Herman, what are the consequences for 2024? Who's going to be the next president of the United States? Can we begin to maybe answer that question after tonight?
Well, I think that's an immensely difficult question to answer, but I do think information has been added to how we look at 2024. One of the real themes coming out of this midterm elections is the underperformance of so-called Trump Republican candidates. And this is actually something that Trump has struggled with, whether his supporters would admit it or not, is in 2020, Trump underperformed the rest of the Republican Party. That is why they came so close to capturing the Senate in 2020, only to lose it because of Trump's shenanigans and you know, torpedoing the Republican efforts in Georgia to capture the two Senate seats there. Here we have a situation where strongly Trumpian candidates, whether it's, you know, Lake in Arizona for the governorship, or whether it is Mehmet Oz in Pennsylvania, whether it is I can't remember the Blake Masters in Arizona and the senatorial race there. These are instances of candidates that were not the first choice of the local Republican Party to a very large extent, or at least were one amongst a field of viable options, who all got the nomination for their respective races when Trump endorsed them. And many of them, perhaps Lake most pertinently, ran on this idea that the 2020 election was stolen, that Donald Trump was genuinely elected president. And there's something very satisfying to see Republicans who went for that angle, who went for that Trumpian angle, they've done badly. They have cost the Republicans several House seats, at least three Senate seats. And if you contrast that to someone like Brian Kemp, in Georgia, and someone like Ron DeSantis in Florida, that ran on a more typical Republican platform, with DeSantis adding some genuine flavor of the culture war element, you're starting to see that the Republicans in 2024 really have a choice between a very good chance at success with independents and moderates going with palatable conservatives, or another tight race, which might as well go for Trump. There's always that possibility, but an uphill struggle to make sure that 2024 on the Senate, House, and presidential level go their way.
Chris, many people have suggested that the control of the Republican Party might be challenged by Ron DeSantis, who's the current Republican governor of Florida, and I'm sure that he is feeling very smug tonight because he pulled off a magnificently satisfying win for himself, I'm sure, in Florida, winning the state by which he only very narrowly won when he was first elected. I think it was just by a few points. I think he won it now by more than 10 points, which is, I think, unexpected, because Florida was, until right quite recently, considered a purple state, but he seems to have turned it red. What's your take on this very briefly?
Only that Biden was said to be you know, perennially weak, and that he wouldn't be able to keep the party together, the different factions, the Democrat Party, and it would all fall apart. And I think maybe the first, not the first, but a civil war is coming, but not in the blue party, but in the red party. So I think you should look out for that heading into 2024, depending on whether how badly Trump still wants to keep a hold of it, as it were, and whether others in the Republican Party go along with that or not. I think this is quite the challenge for McCarthy and the House.
The rumors are that Trump's going to announce his next presidential bid on the 15th of November.
Yeah. Yeah, so good luck to the House and to McCarthy now in terms of keeping it together somewhat. It might even provide gaps for Biden to still pursue his agenda, but at this point in time, I think quite the indictment of the direction of the Republican Party up until this point.
Indeed. All right. That is all the time we have for today. So thank you very much for listening. We hope that you found it interesting, and we will see you guys tomorrow on the Daily Fringe Show. Cheers, everyone.